Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Welcome to the LaRouche Connection. This is Tony Papert. It's Monday, March 19, 2001, in the midst of the great crash of 2001. Our show tonight features continuing coverage of the fight to save D.C. General Hospital. We're updating you because in the past 2 weeks, since our show covered this subject last, we've mobilized tremendous forces in the effort to save the hospital, even though it's still an open question in the last analysis as we talk now. We bring you tonight sections of a town meeting of Wednesday, March 14th, to save D.C. General, the only public hospital in Washington, the only hospital in the quarter of the city that it serves. Lives are already being lost because of the threat to shut the hospital down. This is the center of the battle over health care policy in the United States. Our second segment brings you part of a Berlin meeting of March 5, 2001, addressed by Lyndon LaRouche and by leading economists from Russia and from Germany. Subject of the conference was the depression collapse in the United States, its causes and cures. And now, the Washington, D.C. town meeting.
I think that there has been a dramatic shift in public opinion. I can't prove that scientifically, but just going out in the community, talking to people, people who yesterday were not all that concerned, now they're concerned. People who were not informed, now they are informed. People who didn't have an opinion about the way things were going, now they suddenly have an opinion. And almost everybody, once they hear the facts about the D.C. General Hospital situation, they're not in favor of what the mayor's in favor of. They don't think that his plan makes any sense. So apparently there's only a small number of people who perhaps have a vested interest. And we're going to hear about some of those vested interests that may be involved that prevent certain public servants from serving the general welfare. It looked like we had an invitation to speak to the Congressional Black Caucus leadership about the issue of D.C. General Hospital until something happened. And the thing that happened that ruined that was that our own congressional delegate didn't like the idea of myself and other people speaking to the Congressional Black Caucus about this issue. Everybody knows her name. The one that's missing in action. And there was a big mystery about, well, why would she be silent about this most important issue to her constituents? And I think we have at least a partial answer, because the Federal Elections Commission requires that certain monies that are received be reported. Now, they can't cover everything that might be received, but certain donations have to be reported, and so we know about those donations. But it sort of makes you wonder what else might be going on. And we have someone on the program who is going to give us some of the results of his in-depth investigations into some of those issues. And that should be very, very interesting. The most important things that came out of last week's town meeting here was the suggestion by the state representative Harold James from Pennsylvania, who spoke. He told us about what had happened in East Germany, where some people just started a seemingly insignificant candlelight vigil, and it started to catch on, just like the flame from one candle can light another candle. And then it just catches on, and you don't know where first candle was, but pretty soon there's many, many candles that are lit all over the place. And so what happened in East Germany was that this became the way that the people expressed their dissatisfaction with what was going on. And it looked insignificant. It looked symbolic. It looked totally without any possibility of changing reality. But before too long, the East German government collapsed under the weight of a candlelight vigil. And so we've had a number of candlelight vigils. I think the first one, if I'm not mistaken, was last Friday at the home of Mr. Eugene Kinlow. Mr. Kinlow is on the control board. He has something to do with the health issues that are considered by the control board. And when he got home that night, there were people in front of his home with lit candles. And because he was actually bringing his wife, who is ill, home from a medical appointment, somehow or other, this activity in front of his home touched his heart. And he joined the candlelight vigil. And as a result of that, he was open to hearing about some of the information about this fly-by-night company out of Arizona and some of their possibly criminal activities, how they defrauded hospitals all over the country. And now this is who the mayor wants to turn our hospital over to. He heard some of that information, and as a result of that, he said that he was going to bring that into the discussion with the control board. Now, we don't know whether or not he really will do that, because these sessions, as we know, take place behind closed doors. They are a most undemocratic kind of a situation. And so maybe that answers some of the questions that people have about a candlelight vigil that was started in a communist country called East Germany, which was most undemocratic in its procedures, in the way that it governed its people. And somebody may have thought, well, we don't have anything like that in this country. This is a democratic country. Until you realize that this is Washington, D.C., and in fact, you are under an undemocratic, dictatorial rule that you have no say-so over. And that's where this feeling of powerlessness comes from, as though we really don't have any say-so in what takes place in our fair city. And these people, they're all powerful, and they decide everything. And that's the hue and the cry that we've heard sometimes from the population. It's a done deal. Even members of the city council, you hear them saying the same thing. It's a done deal. And some of us have thought, it's a done deal. They can do anything they want to do. But the reality of it is they can't do anything they want to do unless we let them do anything they want to do. But when we stand up or do a little symbolic act like lighting a candle, then they find out that they can't do what they want to do. They can only do that in the dark. But when you light a candle, then that brings the light.
Turns out that the oldest hospital in the city of Berlin, founded in 1872, has come under budgetary pressure, and the Senate has made a decision to reduce the deficit by shutting down this hospital. This hospital leads Germany in invasive surgery procedures. It is one of seven of the leading anti-tumor specialists, and it particularly has expertise in removing complicated tumors from elderly patients. I understand that our people now in Germany have contacted the people in Berlin and that they are very interested in using the model of fighting that we have adopted here around the Fight to Save DC General. And they are going to be demanding that the German federal government move in to protect the general welfare of the citizenry with national emergency funds to be provided to save this hospital. And they are extremely excited and moralized by what we have done here. We said when we began this effort that DC General was absolutely not a local fight, that it had global, national, as well as global significance, that all over the planet we had a major crisis in healthcare, and people were looking here to the citizens in the nation's capital. You know, sometimes we don't realize it, but a citizen of this nation has far more power than virtually any other person in the world. I told you some stories a few weeks ago about how the life expectancy had been reduced from about 55 years of age in Zimbabwe and Zambia down to 32 and 33 years of age life expectancy for a citizen. Now, what power does the president of those countries have? The president of Zimbabwe spoke out about the AIDS epidemic and was virtually crucified in the press, as was Mbeki from South Africa, because they said this was a problem of poverty. So these people are looking to us. They are looking to the citizens of the nation, and particularly the citizens of the capital. So when we went up to Capitol Hill last week, 150 person plus strong, as full citizens, not as slaves, not as people who are going to bend down, roll over, and just allow a bulldozer to run over us. That was power. And the entire world was watching. So I think everybody here should be very, very proud, and we are going to continue, and we are going to escalate that struggle.
Now, did you know that there's another city council? Not the one you elected. There's something called the Federal City Council.
Mm-hmm. You've heard of this, right?
It's not federal, and it's not a city council, but that's its name. It's a private organization, and it represents the power in Washington, D.C. to apply against the people of the city. It was set up in the 1950s by the Washington Post. And the Washington Post runs it to this present day. Among the trustees are Mrs. Graham, her son, who's the nominal owner, she's still the real owner, and also Bo Jones, the publisher. The three of them are trustees. The head of this secret organization that runs Washington effectively, his name is Terry Golden. He's also the president of Marriott Hotels. He was the head of the General Services Administration in the second Reagan administration. I'm sure he worked with people like Oliver North in setting up the facilities for the government at that time to work things out here. But what is this group? It represents the leading real estate companies, the leading bankers, the accountants who can figure out what the books should be doing, what bookkeeping procedure should be taken by the city, where the money is supposed to go, and so forth. This Federal City Council set up a coalition between Washington and Baltimore rich people to try to get the Olympics here for the year 2012. And they say that we'll get billions of dollars for Washington if we have these Olympics. There's only one small problem. We need to move all the poor people out of the city so it looks better.
And you see it on the big banner we have across the street, which is that we are going to campaign an aspect of what is going on with the attacks against D.C. General is an operation to remove African Americans, to remove Pilcom, the right kind of credit card, to get them out of Washington, D.C. And this was a project, and it was a term coined by some of the Confederates in the U.S. Congress and their Wall Street cronies back in the 1950s, which was called the Negro Removal Project. And there was an entire area down in the Southwest, 22,500 families that were simply relocated out of that area in the 1950s.
Now we move to Lyndon LaRouche's address to that Berlin meeting, March 5th, the depression in the U.S. and what to do about it.
As we now plunge toward the depths in the worst global financial crisis in more than a century, only among three national powers, which were principal victors in World War II, the British monarchy, the United States, and Russia, do we find among the people the historically defined cultural optimism and temperament needed to lead the introduction of a new world economic order for the planet as a whole. Only in two of these three, the United States and Russia, do we find any inclination among leading political institutions to look back to the Roosevelt era and to the 1945-1965 reconstruction of Western Europe as the basis for challenging the rampant follies practiced under the present IMF and World Bank systems. Otherwise, among the NATO members of continental Europe, there has been heretofore a prevalent disposition to capitulate, however reluctantly, to Anglo-American policies situated within the post-1989 conditionalities, such as free trade and globalization. Inside the United States itself, despite the efforts to prevent such a catastrophe by me and by some other leading Democratic Party circles, there is realistically the likelihood that the Bush administration, like the Ozymandias of the famous Shelley poem, might be stubbornly doomed to a self-induced early imperial disaster. Certainly only madmen within the United States would wish such a catastrophe to occur. But only wishful thinking would mislead any leading circles in any part of this planet into disputing the fact that a self-inflicted doom of the present U.S. administration is the only probable outcome of any continuation of recent decades' global trends in policy shaping. For these and related reasons, for the foreseeable period ahead, the Roosevelt recovery in the United States and its application to post-war cooperation between the United States and Western Europe represents the only workable recovery policy which has any chance of being adopted as a leading legal precedent for that quality of cooperation which might provide a timely response to the presently accelerating world financial collapse. Therefore, if we can assume that the United States were to come to recognize that it must reverse its current policy, it must prepare to cooperate with leading nations of Eurasia in launching a recovery based on the principles which account for the economic successes of 1933-1965, then, under that condition, the combination of the United States, continental Europe, and the keystone nations of Asia would represent a sufficient basis for bringing about the kind of reforms which are now urgently needed by this planet as a whole. There is no other happy option presently available for this planet as a whole. Admittedly, the recently installed U.S. Bush administration seems absolutely predetermined to go in directions which are directly opposed to what I propose. Granted, that administration might maintain its present track in policy making, up to what would be an extremely bitter end for the world at large. Therefore, at its worst, the global situation defined by that administration has already displayed all the essential features of a classical Greek tragedy. However, this is unfolding in real life, not on a stage. Astonishing trends can occur. During the near term, the institutions of the United States will experience onrushing crises, far worse than anything they would presently imagine in general. Under those bone-crushing pressures, the present U.S. government might be changed, either from within or without, or a combination of both. That is to say, if there are institutions in the United States which might put tremendous pressure on the Bush administration to change its ways, if those pressures from Europe what for the United States were combined with pressures from Europe, under those conditions, somebody would talk to the U.S. government and the U.S. government would change its policy. That change, if it is to occur, must come soon, or the worst result for the planet as a whole is more or less inevitable. Either way, there is no possibility, no circumstance under which the present economic policy outlooks of the new United States administration could succeed. Whatever happens, one way or the other, the early catastrophic failure of these policies themselves is absolutely inevitable. The signs of such a collapse are being displayed daily. However, the danger to the world at large is this, that like a maddened bull elephant, a desperate Bush administration's effort to offset its economic failures with combined domestic and global crisis management methods could plunge the entire planet into homicidal chaos. That's the danger. When we in the United States and Europe contrast the lessons of the Roosevelt legacy with the growing world financial and economic disaster, which has been wrought over the recent three decades, there is clearly an urgent compulsion to abandon the recent decades' trends in policy shaping and to return as suddenly as may be necessary to the Roosevelt alternative. However, that Roosevelt precedent, while indispensable, is not sufficient. Today, for the world at large, there is probably no effective substitute for the use of the Roosevelt legacy as the legal and diplomatic precedent which must be used. However, we must also be aware of the risks we would incur if Roosevelt's achievements were degraded to a mere model of a statistical type. These risks are the focus of my attention here. One of the most common blunders of professional economists today is their attempt to explain the present crisis, if indeed they recognize it at all, by treating it as if it were a cyclical rather than a systemic crisis. What grips the world today is not a periodic or cyclical crisis. It is a systemic breakdown which has been caused by the accumulation of wrong-headed, popularized axiomatic assumptions, which has been built into our policymaking by monetary authorities, leading banking institutions, universities, and governments, and even public schools and popular entertainment, that over a period of more than 30 years. No systemic crisis, such as this one, could be competently described or controlled by today's commonly taught statistical or monetarist methods. As the founder of modern astrophysics, Johannes Kepler, said of Copernicus' connected dots misestimation of the orbits of the planets, the Roosevelt economic policy worked and was certainly better than any alternative adopted earlier. Yet, if we think of our past or future consequences of an asteroid crashing upon the Earth, we must recognize that some apparently regular trajectories within the solar system may conceal some awesomely deadly systemic failures, all too easily overlooked by mere statisticians. We must look at the world today as Kepler looked into the orbit of Mars. We must discover the deeper principles which actually govern an observed experience within our solar system. It is not sufficient to try to imitate the successes of some observed period. We must discover and apply the underlying principles which made possible an earlier successful trajectory of developments. We must see the danger of thinking simplistically about these matters. Asteroids, which apparently lie in a very reliable orbit, sometimes crash on Earth with horrible effects, and so do economies. As Franklin Roosevelt explained, the methods which he applied to the aftermath of the 1929-1933 World Depression were the methods of that American system of political economy, methods shared between Alexander Hamilton and a key Hamilton collaborator, FDR's ancestor, Isaac Roosevelt. Hamilton and Isaac Roosevelt had acted in opposition to one of the two leading U.S. assets of the British Foreign Office at that time, the Bank of Manhattan's Aaron Burr. The other was Albert Gallatin, who was in the Jefferson and Madison administrations. As Roosevelt emphasized during his years as a university student and later as president, he located himself as a representative of the founders of the United States and as in opposition to what Roosevelt himself described as those American Tories, who were in fact typified by such predecessors in office as President Theodore Roosevelt, a Ku Klux Klan fanatic known as Woodrow Wilson, and Calvin Coolidge. Roosevelt had been born, raised, and matured in the American intellectual tradition of Presidents James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, and Abraham Lincoln. He, like economist Alexander Hamilton, Friedrich List, and Henry C. Carey, was a principled and vocal opponent of the American Tory tradition. As Abraham Lincoln defeated the virtually treasonous American Tory legacy of the Democratic Party of 1829 through 1861. So Franklin Roosevelt, a publicly avowed representative of the American intellectual tradition, reversed the catastrophic effects of the economic policies of the American Tory president, Calvin Coolidge. During the entire period he was president, Roosevelt denounced what he condemned as the 18th century methods of the British monarchy. He rejected the notion of a post-war world under the methods of Adam Smith, and during the course of World War II proposed to introduce the American methods of Hamilton, List, and Carey to a post-war world suddenly liberated of the vestiges of Portuguese, Dutch, British, and French colonialism. In order to avoid the dangers of a simplistic imitation of the Franklin Roosevelt legacy, one must recognize it as an imperfect but successful remedial application to a time of crisis of the American intellectual tradition in economic policy. By American intellectual tradition, I signify the classical European tradition of Gottfried Leibniz's influence on the U.S. Declaration of Independence and upon the economic policies of Alexander Hamilton. I signify the repeated successful application of what Hamilton, Matthew Carey, Friedrich List, and Henry C. Carey defined as the American system of political economy. This was the same American system which from 1877 on played a crucial part in Bismarck's launching of the industrialization of Germany and the industrialization of Russia under leaders such as the great Mendeleev. The commonplace, potentially catastrophic blunder made by many economists, historians, and others today runs as follows. They would say, if the economic crisis is as bad as you say it is, then perhaps we should consider adding some amendments to the otherwise irreversible existing trends in policymaking. It is precisely that kind of popularized, simplistic, statistical thinking which has done so much in the recent period to mislead the world into the present economic mess. We must cease the absurd practice of applying the statistical theory of kinematic percussions among inanimate objects in the attempt to explain away the willful collective behavior of living human beings. The behavior of economies, as measured over a generation or longer, is chiefly predetermined by those intentions which are expressed in the form of long-term investments and related long-term policies made by governments and private interests over periods of not less than a generation yet to come.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
By long-term policies, one should mean the impulse of society to invest with the accompanying intention that these investments shall become successful ones. These intentions are expressed not only as financial investments, but as long-term physical investments in the future strategic development of the population, the land area, the fostering of scientific discovery, and the instruments of production, like even the existence of today's young adult. Today's conditions are the result of intentions expressed by their parents a generation earlier. The only sane government and the only sane form of economy are those with sane intentions, which commit the actions and resources existing in the present to the aims of the future. These are economies like the U.S. economy under Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, or the Fifth Republic France under President Charles de Gaulle, which is sometimes called dirigist because of the clarity and efficiency of their strategic economic intentions. It was chiefly the intentions set into place as policies and policies of practice over the recent 30 years which have created the cumulative effects being experienced as the global financial collapse of today. Today's crisis is not a result of some statistical theory. It is a result of wrong-headed intentions, such as the intention to impose free trade and the intention to globalize the spread of such commodities as deadly epidemic diseases of human and animal populations. Today's crises are the result of intentions which have been adopted by governments, by financial institutions, and by popular opinion over a period of not less than three decades. Inside the United States itself, today's crisis is the natural outcome of trends introduced since the 1966-1972 changes in direction of U.S. policymaking. Trends signified by the growing influence of the Mont Pelerin Society and by the pro-racist intentions of U.S. President Nixon, who perpetrated the terrible mistake of August 1971. As Kepler showed, the orbital pathway of a lawful trajectory of non-uniform curvature, which is what a human process is determined by what must be characterized and adduced as its characteristic intention. For the same reason, the only valid assessment of a systemic financial economic crisis such as the present one requires that we define that crisis not as an inevitable calamity, but instead define those principles which require that she would intend to return to that former trajectory which was successful, to that change which would lead to the imperiled system's survival. Instead of debating whether or not we today should blindly imitate the programs of Franklin Roosevelt, we should examine his intention in introducing those programs and contrast his intentions with the intentions of the faction behind President Coolidge's creation of the Depression, which the impossible Coolidge bestowed upon his own immediate and unfortunate successor, Herbert Hoover. Roosevelt did not simply concoct a package of policies for responding to a depression. Roosevelt used the failure of Coolidge's economic policies, which were modeled on those of Britain, as proof that we must return to the patriotic policy-making philosophy whose violation had caused the crisis. The essential action by President Roosevelt was that he used the then most recent failure of the British free trade system, that of the 1920s, as evidence of the need to return to the superior philosophy of the American intellectual tradition and its intentions. He led the people of the United States out of the Depression by leading them away from the delusions which had controlled most of popular opinion prior to the 1929-1932 disaster. Today, we have the fact of the process of the U.S. recovery from Coolidge's free trade philosophy's depression of 1929-1933. Our older generations have experienced the success resulting from Roosevelt's return to the methods of the American system over the interval 1933-1945, and the application of that experience to the rebuilding of war-torn Europe during the 1945-1965 interval. Now, the present generation, occupying most positions of power, has experienced 35 years of the United States slide into the present new depression, a potentially bottomless depression caused by return to not only the free trade policies of the Coolidge period, but wildly utopian policies, which are far worse than those of Coolidge. The challenge facing us today is to use the evidence that the ruling intentions of the world's leading economic policies over the recent 30-odd years have been a catastrophe for mankind. This evidence of catastrophe must prompt us to change the present intentions of governments and other relevant institutions accordingly. We must now do as Franklin Roosevelt did in response to the 1929-1933 Depression. We must clear away the rubble of those policies which, as intentions, have brought about our ruin, and install instead those intentions of law which correspond to proven principles of policymaking from successful earlier times. The crucial political issue separating President Roosevelt's policies from all of those of his opponents, including his opponents during his life, during his presidency, and from the time of President Nixon to the present day. Roosevelt's policies were all based on his defense of the so-called General Welfare Clause of the preamble of the U.S. Constitution. The principle of the general welfare is a summation of the opening paragraphs of the U.S. Declaration of Independence, and is that declaration of intention of law from which all constitutionally legitimate actions of a government of the United States are derived. For as long as he was president, Roosevelt won most, if not all, of his struggles to base the entire policy of the United States on that constitutional principle of the general welfare. Since Republican Nixon's alliance with the Ku Klux Klan and kindred types during his 1966-1968 campaign for election as U.S. president, no president but Bill Clinton has offered any significant defense of that principle of the general welfare. And he, Clinton, during the summer of 1996, compromised that principle under maniacal demands from his crazy Vice President Al Gore and others among my political adversaries within the Democratic Party. The issue of the general welfare is the most crucial of all of the economic policy issues which we of all relevant nations must intend to confront if we are to succeed in rescuing the world from its presently onrushing catastrophe. We must therefore trace the present global economic disaster to a persistently recurring effort over the course of the 20th century to reverse the course of the entirety of modern European history by going back to not only the imperial models of ancient Rome, but also the traditions of the Venice orchestrated anti-state wars of the 13th through 15th century, and to the Venice orchestrated religious wars which dominated Europe during the period between 1511 and 1648. Today, we must call that revived pro-oligarchical intention to return to medieval society globalization. The characteristic effect of the practice of what is called globalization is the crushing of any law which defends the principle of national sovereignty. It demands, under the fraudulent use of the term rule of law, a sweeping planet-wide nullification of the principle known by the terms the general welfare or the common good. To understand that issue, we must understand its origins and its location in the history of today's globally extended modern civilization. The following historical background is a bare statement of the essential historical background which must be referenced for shaping policy today. As a reaction against the horrors of both the new dark age of Europe's 14th century and the continuation of the Hundred Years' War into the middle of the 15th century, the 15th century produced that antidote to feudalism known as the modern nation-state, sovereign nation-state. This new form of nation emerged first in France as France was reformed by King Louis XI. And following that, the great reform conducted in England under Henry VII. These developments from the 15th century established the beginning of modern economies, and the great improvements in demographic characteristics and conditions of life of populations which have resulted from the influence of that new nation-state form of society. The central feature of that revolution called the sovereign nation-state economy was the introduction of a principle, as I've said, known as the general welfare, or otherwise called the common good. This new principle of law, launched in the 15th century, was the intention that no government has the legitimate moral authority to rule except as it is officially committed to promote the general welfare of all of the living and their posterity. So the law lies not in its text, but the law lies in the effective expression of its intention. So by their intentions do economies, even entire civilizations, choose their destiny. This principle of the 15th century overturned the habits of ancient Babylon, of the Roman empires and their like, under which populations were divided between a ruling oligarchical minority and its armed and other lackeys on the one side, and on the other side a mass of persons degraded in practice to the status of virtual human cattle. Despite the use of religious warfare and other means, in the efforts by the feudal tradition to halt and reverse the development of the sovereign nation state, The benefits of the introduction of the sovereign nation state had been irreversible, even during two devastating world wars of the 20th century, until that presently ongoing downturn, which was set into motion during the recent 30-odd years. The new emphasis upon the development of the Renaissance's new emphasis, on the development of infrastructure, on the fostering of scientific and technological progress, and the gradual freeing of the serfs, and related intentions characteristic of the nation-state institution, had resulted in a rise in life expectancies, improvements in the general demographic characteristics of households and populations in general, and secular increase in the per capita and per square kilometer productive powers of labor. The intentions expressed by the sovereign nation state, by which one generation defines the future for one or two generations yet to come, spilled over into all forms of modern European society and beyond. However, because of the continuing legacy of the feudal tradition in modern Europe, the idea of the sovereign nation state created in Europe was exported to find its more fulsome initial expression in the creation and development of the U.S. Republic in North America. From its colonial beginning through the victory of President Abraham Lincoln and into the last quarter of the 19th century, that the characteristic economic and related forms of intentions of the U.S. form of industrialized nation-state were reflected more and more in the development of Europe itself. The accelerated industrial development of Germany, Russia, and Japan during the last quarter of the 19th century and beyond merely typify the impact of the 1861-76 successes of the U.S. economy on the thinking and practice of many nations in many parts of Eurasia. And thus, although the development of the U.S. Republic was set back severely by the French developments of 1789-1815 and by the hostile actions of both the British monarchy and the Holy Alliance, President Lincoln's triumph over Lord Palmerston's Confederacy puppet sealed the character of the U.S. economy until the downturn which was unleashed about three decades ago. During the 20th century, following the 1901 assassination of President McKinley, the American Tory faction seized control of the United States government and much of the economy besides. However, despite that, Franklin Roosevelt temporarily reversed that trend of 1901-1932, turning the United States back to the economic policies of the Lincoln legacy. In all of these successive turns, despite the repeated reversals of many of the characteristic economic intentions of the United States, the underlying character of the democratic republican principle survived until the increasingly intensified efforts to uproot them over the post-1965 period to date. It is through the understanding of the role of such latter intentions rather than any statistical model that the ebbs and flows of the U.S. economy are to be understood. The crucial issue of intention is the conflict between the heritage of Leibniz's notion of the general welfare principle, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, as expressed in the U.S. Declaration of Independence, and the corresponding oligarchical notion of the ideas of the Confederacy, the ideas of the pro-slavery John Locke, the notion of life, liberty, and property, or what is called today in U.S. law, shareholder value. The latter is typified today by this neo-Confederacy dogma, shareholder value, which is currently enforced by a radically positivist, pro-racist majority of the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Republic has been from its beginning a political battleground, where the patriotic faction, committed to the principle of the general welfare, battles out the issues of economic, social, and foreign policy, with the opposing faction, which Franklin Roosevelt identified as the American Tories. Since the 1966-1968 election campaign of President Richard Nixon, it is the American Tories who have been increasingly in the saddles of U.S. political and economic power in both leading U.S. parties. The issue of the general welfare, to which the present administration and the current majority of the U.S. Supreme Court are opposed, is the essential line of division between two opposing sets of axioms of U.S. policymaking in the matter of foreign and domestic policy and economic and social policy generally. just as the crisis of 1929-33 brought President Franklin Roosevelt's legacy, his advocacy of the general welfare, to power, so the onrushing collapse of the U.S. economic policies of the past 30 years may signal another turn back to the policy of the general welfare, as happened in 1932-1933 with Roosevelt. If that happy turn were to occur, the tendency would be for the United States to mobilize itself for the kind of cooperation with Eurasia, which I've indicated. This is a big if, but it's the best option available to us, and we better work for it. The principle of the general welfare means that it must be the constitutional quality of intention of governments, that governments can make no law or kindred convention which might treat the majority of its population as human cattle. The government's primary goals are to defend the integrity of the nation in the interest of all of the people and their posterity. These goals are to develop its territory in ways which promote the improvement of the demographic characteristics of the population as a whole, and also the average physical productive powers of labor. These obligations of government define our planet as what the celebrated Vladimir Vygotsky defined as a noosphere. In other words, human creativity is deployed with the intention to maintain, transform, and improve the biosphere for human existence, and to accomplish this by means which include the intention for developing the general area through appropriate large-scale infrastructural improvements such as in water management, power production, transportation, and so on. The realization of the objectives of a noosphere also require the intention of an increase in the knowledge and productive powers of the population, largely through aid of scientific and technological progress. Only in such a way, through such intentions, could the general welfare be served. This obliges governments to place the primary emphasis on its intentions on the physical side of production as such, and to regulate the financial side of policymaking to those measures needed to facilitate trade and employment in fostering physically beneficial significant developments. A sound economic system is therefore primarily a physical system by intention, and a financial system only by derivation. The required intention is the acceptance of the physical obligation to promote the general welfare through economic growth, an obligation which obliges government to expend great efforts on behalf of its intention to promote the improvement of what we call basic economic infrastructure. In practice, we find that such public works may be undertaken either solely by the efforts of government itself or undertaken by privately owned public utilities, each case acting according to regulations provided and maintained by government. For example, in effecting the Roosevelt recovery of the U.S. economy during 1933-1945, about 40% of the total economic growth stimulated by government action was in the area of basic economic infrastructure. And much of the remaining private sector's growth depended upon the government-sponsored efforts, such as the famous Tennessee Valley development. The choice of public or private ownership is of little significance in and of itself, if either fulfills the intention more or less equally well. Franklin Roosevelt used both, government and the private sector, as the example of the work of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation illustrates that point. The matter of intention of law in these matters lies in the mechanisms of regulation by which either public or private or combined both ownerships of public works shall conduct their business. In order to stimulate both public and private improvements, it must be the intention of society that prices must be set at levels which provide for the maintenance of basic economic infrastructure and also capital improvements and high skill levels in production of goods and essential services. In other words, the general welfare requirement cannot be served without protectionist measures of a type which can be assured only through the sovereignty of the authority of a sovereign nation state's government. The alternative to such intentions is economic anarchy and ruin. The globalizer's intentions and insistence that government not only abandon such sovereign nation-centered intentions, or protectionist ones, but relinquished forever the authority to adopt them, is the principal cause for the systemic character of that catastrophe in which the world is being plunged today. For example, to rebuild the tattered and shattered world economy of today, large masses of credit must be created and issued at low borrowing costs over periods of maturity ranging up to a quarter century or more. With such public credit policies, and with protectionist measures of the sort which were widely employed during the 1945-1965 period, large-scale improvements with increasing rates of productivity and technological progress were available and are available, even as in regions as devastated as war-torn Europe. The catastrophic economic and related effects of globalization have recently increased the recognition that only through new forms of closer cooperation among the leading nations of continental Eurasia is there any visible opportunity for the general economic prosperity of continental Eurasia as a whole. A pattern of negotiations to this effect has emerged among the nations of Western continental Europe and Russia, together with increasing emphasis on wider cooperation with the great population centers of Central, East, Southeast, and South Asia. In these matters, the need to provide mutual security among all the nations of Eurasia and the need for new forms and degrees of economic cooperation are inseparable practical concerns. This emphasis on Eurasia is not to the disadvantage of Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and the Americas. Quite the contrary. Without a general economic recovery in continental Eurasia, there is no hope for any part of this planet as a whole. The national economies of Eurasia represent nations and cultures with significant differences in their characteristics. However, all share in common the need for similar benefits as measured in physical economic terms. The most urgent elements of economic cooperation needed among this assortment as a whole are preponderant emphasis on the development of basic economic infrastructure, without which other improvements in the life of the population were not possible. This also requires large-scale and growing transfers of advanced productive technology from those places where fountains of technology may be found into areas in which the deficit of such technological infusions must be corrected. The objectives of such cooperation are generally in the order of the required work of two generations, the coming quarter century most urgently. This requires a system of long-term, relatively fixed parities among currencies and upper limits on borrowing costs and conditions in which rates of between 1 and 2% per annum, simple interest and not compound interest, must prevail. The great bulk of the flows of physical capital will be concentrated in long-term credits in the order of about 25 years. A quarter to one-half of the long-term credit and trade agreements will come under such provisions. The experience under the Bretton Woods Agreement during the period until about 1965 provide appropriate precedents. On the side of monetary and financial practices, this will require the forms of regulation which prevailed during the 1945-1965 interval, with initial emphasis on the more strict regulations of the 1945-1958 interval. Additionally, special attention must be given to lessons of leading military and other great science driver programs of the 1940-1965 interval, including the Kennedy manned moon landing program. The success of the recovery program required for Eurasia and elsewhere today will depend upon the rapidity which can be achieved in science driver modes of technological progress. When we consider the area of Eurasia as a whole, and also take into account the needs for technological progress among the dense population areas of East, Southeast, and South Asia, the goals of recovery cannot be achieved without aid of a greatly accelerated rate of technological progress. Only a science driver strategy could ensure the acceleration of the rate of technological progress to needed levels. This will require a twofold direction of change in the structural composition of employment and education within the labor force of Europe and the United States in particular. To fulfill our part in the partnership with the technologically less developed portions of the world. We must increase greatly the ration of the total labor force employed in producing science and technology, and we must shift the quality of employment of the remainder of the labor force upward technologically. By these shifts in priorities for education, investment, and employment, we will be able to generate accelerated rates of increase of the per capita physical productive powers of labor in what are presently termed the advanced sector, and thus to generate high rates of physical productivity into the employment in the less advanced sectors of the world. That means physical economic targets for the immediate quarter century ahead, and monetary and financial policies designed to match the standards defined in physical economic terms. To this end, we must clarify our intentions. If we do so, we might imagine that President Franklin Roosevelt, wherever he is today, would smile. Thank you.
You've been watching the LaRouche Connection. The LaRouche movement and its allies have mobilized so many forces in the fight to save D.C. General that this past Saturday, March 17th, the Washington Post, which has led the fight to close the hospital down, had to reverse itself in its lead editorial and call for saving D.C. General. Tune in next week.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.